This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Good evening. This is Suzanne Ross sitting in for Sally O'Brien on Where We Live. We have a very interesting show tonight. As many people are probably expecting by now, it'll be about Mumia Abu-Jamal, but let's hear from Mumia first.
Mumia, what's your reaction?
Well, all I know is, you know, what Christina told me, so there's nothing.
That's right.
So we don't know anything. And, if it is the Batson issue, then it just shows you that precedent means nothing, that the law is politics by other means, and that the Constitution means nothing, that a fair jury means nothing, you know.
You said when I just first talked to you something about it's another day and how many days?
Another day and three decades.
When did you stop being surprised?
When I was at pretrial hearing before Judge Szabo, and he denied the motion. I knew then that he wasn't working with the Constitution. It did surprise me, and it really shocked me because, you know, I'd read the cases. I knew what the law was. I knew what the law book said the law was. I learned then that they're not going by that kind of law. And apparently they're not going by that kind of law now. You know, if you read Batson and you read my case, then it's almost as if you're in two different universes. And in fact, you are. You are.
Are there different rules for what type of people?
Well, there's always been different rules for black people. You know, if you read Batson, what will surprise people who have never done so, it has nothing to do with the accused, the defendant, the person on trial. Batson, in its own terms, says it protects the rights of those people who are allegedly American citizens who are denied the right to serve as jurors. That's what it says. That's what it says. But in fact, you know, how does it do that when it allows people to be removed after Batson became law for spurious reasons? You know, Batson can be bested and beaten by exactly the way the DA's office said it could be beaten, by lying and getting up and saying, well, no, we didn't have any racist reasons, and we're not, you know, listen to the videotape.
You have 60 seconds remaining.
Listen to the videotape, and if that doesn't tell you all you need to know, then you're either deaf, dumb, or blind.
Whose videotape?
The videotape of the DA, the training videotape of Jack McMahon of the Philadelphia DA's office from 1986.
Okay, so that's Mumia speaking right after the Supreme Court decision a few days ago, and we'll be addressing that in just a minute with a really strong group of speakers. We have Vincent Sutherland of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, who will be speaking shortly, followed by Lynn Washington. Many of you have heard Lynn Washington many times, the fantastic journalist who knows Mumia's case inside out, and finally the leader of the Mumia movement, both nationally and internationally, Pam Africa. But before we go on to Mumia, I want to take the privilege for a moment. I'm speaking only for myself and the Free Mumia Coalition and the International Concerned Family and Friends, not for Sally O'Brien, with whom I did not have a chance to clear this. I want to explain that a letter was sent out to Grace Aaron, the interim executive director of Pacifica, and it was signed by Betty Dobson, Dr. James McIntosh, both of them of CMOTAP, the Committee to Eliminate Media Offensive to African People, and myself on behalf of the Free Mumia Coalition and International Concerned Family and Friends. So I just want to explain that the reason we were concerned, the reason we sent a letter to Grace Aaron asking for a meeting on behalf of a group of listeners and staff people, concerned staff and listeners. And our particular concerns were that the national office was coming in at this point. Grace Aaron is in town with several people from KPFK. She was coming in, presumably, to, as we ultimately found out, to change the locks on the signal, the tower signal, to possibly, in other words, change control of who had access to it. This is what we heard. I mean, this is what she ultimately explained, and to address issues, problems, quote, something like problems about program. And the general manager of WBAI, Anthony Riddle, had not heard about this, was not only not consulted, but was not told directly, found out indirectly. So that raised a lot of concern for a lot of us who lived through the coup, the last coup, and who were very concerned about any hint of a national takeover, any hint of lack of respect or recognition of local control, and in particular on the issue of programming, the strong direction toward diversity that has been where this station has been going toward. So we were very concerned about that. I'm happy to announce that a decision, we asked for a meeting, and apparently the local board of BAI has agreed. We heard last night, I heard this from somebody last night from the local board, that there will be a meeting on Monday night, a town hall meeting on Monday night at 7 p.m., I'm not sure, actually, about the time. The time and the place were not specified, just that there will be a meeting, a town hall meeting, Monday night. So we're happy about that, and we ask everybody to come out to express their concern, why they, you know, what they feel strongly about in relation to BAI. After all, this is a listener-supported station, so this, all the listeners should come in and voice their positions. As far as finding out exactly where the place is and the time, you can check on WBAI.org. That's the station's main website, WBAI.org. Or you can go to justiceunity.org or call 212-591-2111. I'm going to repeat all of that. WBAI.org, JusticeUnity.org, 212-591-2111. And I hope this will be a productive meeting and that we move forward in the positive direction that is so important for the diverse population of this great city. So with that having said, I hope Pam Africa is on the phone and Lynn Washington. Are you both there?
I'm here.
And yeah, Lynn?
Hi, Suzanne. I'm here.
Greetings. Greetings. And meet Vincent Sutherland, who's sitting right next to me. Oh, from the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. I don't think either of you has met him yet.
No, just over the phone.
And hello. Brother Ari from the Free Mumia Coalition and from Friends of Move, who's also in the studio.
On the move, Ari.
Okay, so we're going to start. The order is going to be we're going to start with Vincent. We heard, people heard the message, the interview that Noel Hanrahan did with Mumia right after the decision. And we're going to start with Vincent giving a presentation of what this legal decision was about. Then we will follow with Lynn, and then Pam, and then we'll open up questions to callers, to listeners. Okay.
Okay.
And I want to welcome all of you, both to the phone and in studio. It's wonderful to have such a great group of people together.
It's very good to be here. Thank you for having me here, Suzanne. With respect to the most recent decision by the Supreme Court, what it really means, Mr. Abu-Jamal was contesting the discriminatory selection of jurors during his 1982 trial, and he was basing that challenge to discriminatory jury selection on a number of factors, a number of facts that happened during the course of his trial. When I say jury selection, what I mean is the process by which the prosecutor and defense attorney sit down before a criminal trial begins, and choose jurors that they feel will be fair and impartial and render a fair and impartial and just decision during the course of the trial. And during that process, the prosecutor and defense attorney has a chance to question the jurors and strike jurors based on whether or not they feel that a particular juror will be suitable for a trial. In Mr. Abu-Jamal's case, one of the broader issues with jury selection is that you cannot select jurors based on race. There cannot be any racial implication in your jury selection process. And if there is, there is a remedy to challenge that process under a case called Batson versus Kentucky, United States Supreme Court, which essentially gave attorneys the ability to question whether or not other attorneys were using their strikes for racist reasons. So that's the kind of the framework under which Mr. Abu-Jamal was working with his legal claim. In Mr. Abu-Jamal's case, the prosecutor used 11 of his 15 strikes to remove black jurors from the jury. And so in the end, Mr. Abu-Jamal's case was tried before a jury of 10 whites and 2 blacks. Beyond the number of strikes that were made by the prosecutor, there's also a culture of discrimination by the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office. Studies had shown that throughout the early 80s and late 90s, a disproportionate number of African Americans were struck from capital juries. And as you heard Mr. Abu-Jamal say during the opening remarks, there's also a training tape by the head district attorney of the homicide division that was released in the mid-80s, in 1986, basically explaining how to be discriminatory in jury selection, how to strike black jurors, and explaining that these prosecutors don't want black jurors on their juries. And if they were to strike black jurors, how to hide that fact from the judge. While the tape wasn't produced right at the time of Mr. Abu-Jamal's trial, we felt that it's indicative of this long-standing history of discrimination by the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office in jury selection at the time. Despite all those pieces of evidence that Mr. Abu-Jamal had brought to the court's attention through his attorney, Mr. Robert Bryan, and through the efforts of LDF, filing a Friends of the Court brief, the Supreme Court decided that they did not want to hear his challenge to jury selection in this case. What that means is that we felt that was probably Mr. Bujamal's best shot at getting a new trial from the beginning, because that's the remedy when there is discrimination in jury selection on appeal. The person who's been convicted will then have a conviction overturned and will be given a new trial. So that avenue of legal attack has been foreclosed by the Supreme Court's decision not to even review the case. And they didn't give any reasons as to why they didn't review the case. They almost never do. It's very rare that a Supreme Court justice will, in some cases, write a dissenting opinion as to why the court should grant review. But in this case, they didn't give any reason at all. And so we can only kind of speculate as to why that was, that they didn't review the case. The more troubling aspect of Mr. Bujamal's case is not only is it a disappointing ruling for Mr. Bujamal in particular, of course, and very, very disappointing, it also has tremendous effect for prisoners and those convicted of crimes throughout the state of Pennsylvania, throughout the Third Circuit, which includes New Jersey and Delaware as well. And across the country, because what the court essentially did by declining to review his case was give an indication as to what level of evidence you need in order to prove discrimination, and or at least ask the question as to whether or not discrimination had taken place. And in this case, despite overwhelming evidence, and despite the overwhelming taint of race throughout the trial, and throughout the trial proceedings, the Supreme Court decided not to even take a look at it. The other disappointing aspect, as I said, is of this case, is that the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania and the District Attorney's Office actually appealed a separate ruling, a separate lower court ruling, and that ruling was what granted Mr. Bujamal sentencing relief. And you know, the lower court, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, the court just below the Supreme Court, said that the jury instructions were such that they were so confusing that the jurors could not have given Mr. Bujamal a fair and just, I guess, decision with respect to the death penalty phase. And so the Third Circuit Court of Appeals ordered the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania to then go back and give Mr. Bujamal either life without parole or a new sentencing hearing. The Commonwealth appealed that decision to the Supreme Court, and if the Supreme Court decides to take a look at that decision and decides to review the decision that throws out the death penalty for Mr. Bujamal, and they decide to reverse that decision, then the death penalty is again back on the table, and Mr. Bujamal will then be, the death sentence will be reinstated. If they decide not to take a look at it and decide to deny review, as they did deny review for Mr. Bujamal's claim of jury discrimination, the case will then go back to the Philadelphia Court of Common Pleas, the trial court, and the District Attorney's Office will have the option of seeking another death sentence. And if they do that, then they will have to have another small jury trial on the question of Mr. Bujamal's sentence, either life without parole or death. And if the District Attorney's Office decides not to seek another death penalty sentence, then Mr. Bujamal will presumably be sentenced to life without parole. So this decision essentially cut off probably his what we felt was probably his strongest chance of getting a new trial.
Could you, before we go to Lynn, could you clarify, there's been talk of appealing this decision?
Certainly. So what Mr. Bujamal's attorney, Robert Bryan, has indicated to his supporters and those involved in the case, such as the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, is that he's going to seek rehearing in the Supreme Court on the Batson issue, on the issue that Mr. Bujamal raised before the court for review. The chances of the court granting rehearing are not phenomenally high. They're not great at all. But it is certainly an avenue and a viable avenue to at least bring to the court's attention again the claim that the discrimination occurred during the course of Mr. Abu-Jamal's trial and jury selection. And so, you know, it's unclear what will happen with that decision or what the court would do. We'll kind of have to wait and see.
Were you all surprised by the decision?
You know, it's difficult to say. I don't know if we were really necessarily. I think we were more disappointed than surprised.
Mm-hmm.
It's tough to say kind of where the court's thinking was in terms of why they decided not to take a look at Mr. Abu-Jamal's case. Of course, there are any number of reasons why they could have decided not to grant review. From a legal standpoint, there were other kind of procedural issues that may have limited the court's ability to take a look at Mr. Abu-Jamal's claim. The fact that, the lower court really kind of looked at it not so much in terms of the amount of discrimination that Mr. Abu-Jamal had shown, but in terms of some missing other pieces of evidence that would warrant review in other types of cases, or other legal procedural maneuvers that would have warranted review in other types of cases. And so, the chances of getting cert granted, getting review granted, are always very, very small in any case. And so, there's certainly something to be said for who Mumia is and all kind of everything that's surrounding his case, all the issues surrounding his case, that make it a very, very disappointing decision to hear from the Supreme Court.
Okay, I'm sure we'll get back to asking more questions, but sure. I want to move ahead with Lynn Washington. So could you say a little bit about your reaction to this decision and where you think things stand or what's happened or however you want to approach it?
Well,
open forum, yep, for you.
Yeah, I've always, my position has been that the U.S. Supreme Court has in the past not acted fairly in the Mumia case, just as the Pennsylvania Supreme Court hasn't, and definitely as the lower courts, the Philadelphia Common Pleas Courts, generally. And Mr. Sutherland could probably speak to this better than I, but generally the U.S. Supreme Court will exercise its power to accept a case for review, a rare case, when that case presents some very meritorious legal issues, when that case is of such high profile or prominence, and if there is a difference in the rulings by the federal appeals courts on a particular issue. So in this particular case, with the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, that's the court that covers the Philadelphia area, essentially creating new standards for what must be proven before you can proceed with a jury discrimination claim, and that this ruling conflicts with previous rulings of the U.S. Supreme Court and other circuits, it was a case very ripe for appeal. However, as many people have characterized and will characterize this case has been impacted by race and politics all along. So the court, I think, just made a political decision and didn't proceed forward with it. We have to remember that back in the early 90s, when Mumia made his initial appeal to the Supreme Court, there was an issue in the case, a very interesting legal issue, about the right, the ability of a person after their conviction and, facing sentence, to make a statement to the court. In many ways, Abu-Jamal was denied that right. He raised that point. The U.S. Supreme Court refused to accept his appeal, just like this time, with no explanation. About a year later, the Supreme Court granted legal relief to a Delaware inmate, a white inmate who had escaped, committed a murder while he was in prison. He was a member of a white supremacist prison gang. They granted him a new hearing based on the fact that his right to make a statement to not have his political associations brought up in court. Abu-Jamal saw that, and he appealed, not only because it was the legal issue involved, the same one in his case, but the Delaware Supreme Court, in certifying this criminal's conviction, used only one case in all of the country to say it was okay to do that, and that was Abu-Jamal's case. The U.S. Supreme Court, for the second time, refused to hear Abu-Jamal's case. And then a few months after that, they gave the same kind of relief to a guy in Nevada who had killed his grandparents, and after killing them, they engaged in a devil-worshipping ritual. So here we have an instance where a white racist prison gang member and a devil worshiper were given relief, and Abu-Jamal wasn't. So we see a whole history, a whole litany of not only the U.S. Supreme Court, but the Pennsylvania Supreme Court and most of the other courts have handled this case, taking rulings that are in wide variance to their existing precedent.
The Mumia exception, you've been referring to it.
Yeah, the Mumia exception. The Mumia exception is when the courts will either ignore or alter their previous law. One issue in this case, in fact, this is one of the issues that the Third Circuit handled a year or so ago. In 1986, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court said that it was illegal for a prosecutor to tell a jury that, you know, don't worry about your verdict because the inmate will have an appeal after an appeal after an appeal. Now, this particular 1986 ruling occurred in a case tried by the same prosecutor who tried him and before the same judge who presided over Mumia's case. When Mumia's case got up to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court in 1989, they said, well, that doesn't apply. We're changing our ruling. Like, what? Yeah, we're changing our ruling in this area. And then in 1991, they changed it back. So that is an exception. When they being the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, made a ruling in his case in March of 1989 when they upheld his conviction, that point that I just made about the First Amendment right association and being able to make a statement to the jury. In February of 1989, they ruled in the case and they said that that particular right is of, quote, such ancient origin that when it's violated, a new trial is automatic. You know, well, not exact quote, but I mean, that's the intent of it. But about 28 days later, they totally changed it around, and they said for the first time that right doesn't apply in capital murder cases. So there's instance after instance after instance where they alter or ignore the law to deny Abu-Jamal justice. And that's what's fundamentally unfair.
You know, I'm not an attorney, but after the Third Circuit decision and reading Judge Ambrose's dissent, mm-hmm. and his laying out in great detail how that court, the other two people who had ruled to not give Mumia a new hearing, how they had violated precedent over and over again on the issue of Batson, and he gave so many cases and explanations in that same court. So, you know, looking at it just as a layperson, I thought, and maybe Vincent later can address this, I thought, well, that might be something the United States Supreme Court, given how central to the United States judicial and legal system precedent is, I thought they might look at that and say something's, I mean, not that I had any faith in the United States Supreme Court. I'm just mentioning this as an, you know, if there were justice, somebody, you know, so many people commented on the outrageous decision made by the Third Circuit in terms of violating the very, very laws and rules they go by. And given the fuss and given Ambrose's dissent and all that, you know, certainly if they had an open mind, or if there was any justice in that United States Supreme Court, they would have said something is wrong here. What we call judicial misconduct, no?
Well, one would have expected a fairer, more even-handed process in this, and one that would have led to a recognition of the overwhelming evidence of jury discrimination. That Third Circuit ruling that you were talking about, Judge Ambrose wrote a very stinging and harsh critique that really exposed all of the flaws that his colleagues had made, and one of those colleagues was the president judge of that circuit. It was, in essence, his boss, and he said, no, you're wrong on law, and here's 44 pages of why you're wrong on law, and the ruling was only like 60 pages. Now, interestingly, one of the cases that Judge Ambrose cited and was cited in the NAACP's case, NAACP Local Defense Fund's brief to the Supreme Court, as well as Robert Bryant's brief, was a case where one of the circuit court judges said that if there is evidence, and even inference of evidence, just the appearance of evidence of discrimination against one juror, then you need to go back and have either a rehearing or a new trial. That particular judge that issued that ruling, and I think it was in 2005, was a Third Circuit judge named Samuel Alito. Well, George Bush appointed Samuel Alito to the U.S. Supreme Court. And last year, I think it was in March, Alito was the author of a ruling at the U.S. Supreme Court, which gave a legal relief to a inmate, a death row inmate down in Louisiana. And he applied that similar kind of a standard. I mean, it wasn't a direct, you know, apples to apples, oranges and oranges case, but it dealt with the issue of jury discrimination and the parameters that they would be permitted. And essentially, he said, one instance of discrimination, you grant relief. And then a few weeks later, the Third Circuit comes out saying, no, you have to prove a whole bunch of other stuff. You have to prove more than just one. So here we have the Third Circuit not only going against its own precedent, which included about six or seven cases, but it went against a Supreme Court ruling that was issued just a few weeks earlier. And apparently, and we don't know how, you know, the vote went in terms of the Abu Jamal case, but one would have expected that Sam Alito would say, hey, this is precedent. Let's follow the precedent. But didn't happen.
They couldn't have missed logically that something was really wrong. I mean, this is not done accidentally or from stupidity. I mean, that's pretty obvious, but
they missed it by being willfully blind.
That's what I'm saying, that this was willful injustice. Pam, you know about willful injustice, right?
Oh, yes, indeed. One of the things I want to point out, and it's a quote from John Africa, that these judges do not have the right to do wrong. And, you know, and that must be understood with people, because everything Lynn said was true, everything our brother from the NAACP legal defense said was true, and it's clear we're not dealing with law, we're dealing with outlaw.
Mm-hmm.
So why are we respecting what it is that these people are saying when they are breaking their own laws? It's very criminal what's happening here, but the end result, what happened with Mumia, is what happened with, you know, brothers and sisters throughout the United States. We have a situation here where the whole world is watching. A lot of people are in shock at what is happening here. And there's those of us who are not in shock about what's happening here, because what's happening today is what went on all the way throughout. But people must understand, Mumia is alive today because of the power of the people, because if these people had their way, Mumia would have been dead when Shaka Sankofa, when they executed him. He would have been dead when our brother Stanley Tookie Williams was executed as well, because Mumia case came along with all of these. But through the power, the consistency of this movement, and because of people like Lynn, people like the brother from the legal defense and people who are around the world who took the stance of naming a street after Mumia in order to show the people the injustices. I'm talking about in Saint-Denis in France, to show the people the consistency and of the wrong that these people were doing. When it was said way back when that Veronica Jones was intimidated, that other witnesses was intimidated and forced to lie, when other people came forth and said Mumia Abu-Jamal did not have a fair trial, what happened to them? What happened 2 years ago to DeLacy Davis, a black cop? And when they say that the only good cop is a dead cop, that's not because we said it. And they actually ran this man off the force. And because he stood up and said exactly that. I'm looking at the case and I see inconsistencies. And when France said it, they threatened to cut off their supply of wine coming into the United States. They threatened to cut off terrorism. And I'm saying we are under siege. And we're dealing with a situation of governmental terrorism enforced by organized crime, the Fraternal Order Police. I think that there should be a civil rights investigation into this case immediately. All those who believe in justice and have those positions who have stood up and said that Mumia Abu-Jamal did not have a fair trial, I'm talking about the entire black congressional caucus. I'm talking about the entire state and senator, legislators who said that they investigated this case. I have not heard one of them stand up. I have not heard not from one of the people who headline churches to stand up and say, let's get together. Let's do for Mumia what we did for Obama. We cannot stand by and allow this government to get away with what they're getting away with simply behind the fact is because it's not just Mumia, it's a whole lot of other people involved here. We must stop allowing this government to do what it is that we're doing. We must end terrorism at home before we dare think about terrorism abroad. I'm saying any time judges can be intimidating. I'm talking about Judge Pamela Denby. I'm talking about Judge Frederica Messiah Jackson, I think her name is, and I'm talking about district attorneys and who have been intimidated. I'm talking about lawyers. I'm talking about a lawyer, a district attorney by the name of Joey Grant, that when we went before Judge Sable in a post-conviction hearing, and this man was like a pit bull at Mumia's throat because he hated him because of what they told him and taught him. But when he was in that courtroom, and he watched all the people who came in there behind Mumia, who testified on behalf of Mumia. Joey Grant said that the character, that it doesn't fit Mumia's character. As soon as he said that, or words similar to that, they got rid of Joey Grant. And, I'm saying these people have no intentions on being fair. Senator Bob Dole said if Mumia got another trial and, he will be set free. Now, why the heck are they saying that? Because of everything that Lenin and them said. Evidence clearly points to the fact you cannot have these pictures that Polakoff pulled up and are showing very clearly that everything they said was a lie. I'm saying it's up to us. Mumia's life and the lives of the other brothers and sisters that's in prison that are innocent and those that are in other positions, their lives is not in the system's hand. It is in our hands. And I'm going to give you clear-cut example of what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the power of the people. A guard told one of our sisters and some inmates that Mumia was found dead in his cell. When our sister called home and told us that, we're taught by John Africa not to assume anything. 20 minutes. And then it was said to put it out over the internet that we want to hear from Mumia. We don't want to hear from any guard, any prison official, or anybody telling us that Mumia is fine. We want to hear from him. Well, I want to tell you something. In 45 minutes, And because of the power of the people, the worldwide power of the people, they brought a phone to Mumia. In order to make a phone call out, your phone number has got to be in the system. This phone number was not in the system. They brought him there and told him, call your family. You're only supposed to be allowed a 15-minute phone call. Mumi was on that phone for 30 minutes. And I'm saying, that's the power of the people. You know, they claimed victory 5 days before or 3 days before. And I'm saying, what kind of victory could they have claimed when once the people stood up and rose up and said, produce Mumia, they did just that. That is our power. We must understand what it is that we can do when we all pull together. We must pull together. Those meetings, we're having one in Philadelphia. There's one in New York. There's one happening up in Boston. Get to those meetings. Put pressure on these officials. Don't allow them to walk by you acting like they're respectable and acceptable and hip. I'm saying let's get organized. Let's go and do what is necessary to stop this murder. Do you know that these judges got together on April 4th? To make this decision, and they announced it on Monday. What was April 4th for the assassination date of Dr. Martin Luther King? What was the date that these devils decided to use when they went to when they first signed the execution warrant for Mumia? And on August the 17th, the Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey's birthday. I'm saying if you're not talking about racism, if you're not talking about terrorism, it's the terrorism in its worst form. But I'm saying we have got to stop being victims, and we got to stand up toe-to-toe with these people and let them know what we're going to accept and what we're not going to accept. And I know damn well we can do it. We can do it because all the evidence is there. Use what we got. We're not without. We have everything there. Len told you. The other brother told you. And with numbers, we don't have no hallucinatory numbers where like the FOP throw stuff up on the TV or on the radio and talk a lot of BS. I'm saying we're in the streets of massive numbers right now all across the country and outside. People are organizing. You have any questions?
So in New York City, we ask everybody to show up Saturday at 6 p.m. at the Solidarity Center. That's 55 West 17th Street. We are going to be brainstorming. We have some proposals. Definitely the Justice Department is a target. Definitely. Because the Justice Department has the power to conduct a civil rights investigation. For those of you who haven't noticed, Eric Holder has just issued the report from the Justice Department that they did a civil rights investigation of Senator Ted Stevens, who had been convicted of all kinds of crimes, and they overturned that conviction based on prosecutorial misconduct. Mumia's case is filled with prosecutorial and judicial misconduct. If he could do it for Ted Stevens, he sure as hell can do it for Mumia, even though we know that the case, you know, the political implications are completely different. But we have to demand that there has to be one standard of justice. They can't provide Ted Stevens, some reactionary, you know, politician, with rights that they're not going to grant to a great revolutionary, Mumia Abu-Jamal. We have to be demanding that. So we're going to have petitions, we're going to have demonstrations, and we need everyone to turn up. Because as Pam said, this event that happened with the announcement that Mumia had been found dead in his cell was yesterday. It seems so much has been happening that it seemed like a week ago, but it was yesterday. And it was quite phenomenal how quickly that response. I want to reiterate that what Pam said was quite remarkable that happened that way. You know, that there was, and when I spoke to the superintendent, I was not home, didn't get the email. Pam told me by phone. When I called the superintendent from the street, he said, we're getting calls from all over the world. I said, you better do something about it because you're going to get a lot more calls and a lot more protests. And they did act on that. So I want to reiterate again, we do have the power. Mumia wouldn't be alive today if we hadn't been fighting all these years. There's no way he would have. They wanted him dead. They still want him dead. So I don't know if any of you want to ask each other questions, or Brother Ori, if you want to add anything, or we can open up the mic for listeners. Did you want to add something, Vincent? Lynn, are you still there?
Oh, yes, I'm here.
Okay. Does any of you want to ask anybody else or make any additional comments before we open up the line?
I want to make a comment.
Go ahead, Ben.
This show should be produced and sent around. I don't know whether it's on the Internet.
Yes, it is going to be on the Internet.
You know, what was laid out here today, people need to know it. They need to be able to repeat it. And when they go and talk with people, if they can't repeat it, give them the disc.
Good
CD,
idea.
And let people hear. And they want to deal with this, call the NAACP Legal Defense. Call Lynn Washington, because they can truly deal with what it is that they're saying, because it is factual. People need to have this, just like they need to have In Prison All My Life, Framing the Execution, and what's the other one? Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. And people need to have these things. Bring people into your living rooms, into your homes, into your churches, and let people hear, and then get out in the street and act like we're fighting for Obama.
And use the new book. Mumia's book is fantastic. It's a very exciting, very inspiring, and informative book, and also shows how outrageous the legal system is, including, in particular, the role of Bill Clinton. So use that book to show how the legal system from Clinton, the great liberal first black president, use it to educate people, to inspire people. And come also, we're planning book parties, of course, for the 24th, 25th, 24th in Philadelphia, 25th in New York City. There's a lot happening. There's no excuse for people not to be involved. There are so many people out there of all ages who know about Mumia's case, who have loved Mumia for his heroism, courage, consistency, and clarity. And that should motivate people, even in a very difficult period, to action. So, Tony, can we open up the lines at this point? Are there any callers? Okay. The number is 209-209-2800. I'll repeat it. 212-209-2900. And please don't make a long speech. Ask a brief question. If you want to address it to one person in particular, you may. Okay. I'm sorry. I'm new to this caller system.
Hello?
Okay, yes. Yes, caller?
Okay. Listen, what was Mumia's initial charge in 1982? That's all.
Killing a cop.
How did his proceedings go? I mean, what was the issue behind the proceedings?
Amnesty International has said very, very clearly that the trial did not meet the most basic standards of either the United States Constitution or international law. And that has been repeated all over the world by hundreds of lawyers, legal organizations, civil rights, and all kinds of... The trial was considered outrageous. In fact, one of the things that's happened is people said, well, don't worry about it. This trial is outrageous, but it's going to be appealed. And later on, nobody's going to support such an outrageous trial. Well, lo and behold, everyone has supported and endorsed that original outrageous trial. So that's the farce of this appeal system that granted no relief at any stage.
Thank you. Yeah.
Go ahead, Lynn.
No, I didn't know if the caller I got off. When Amnesty talks about this trial not meeting international standards, I mean, that's a very profound observation, quite accurate. What does it really mean? Well, it means this. Abu-Jamal wanted to exercise his right of self-defense. He was denied that. The prosecutor came in and said, you know, Judge, I think this guy is scaring the jurors. So they took away his right to represent himself. Newspaper accounts and other news media accounts at the time said that he was very calm, very deliberate. He wasn't scaring anybody, but they stripped him of that right. Mm-hmm. He had an attorney who was assigned backup job to because he was going to represent himself. Mm-hmm. Then this attorney was thrust in to the role of lead counsel. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
He did no preparation because he wasn't supposed to do any preparation because he was going to do the background. But let me just show you one of the fundamental unfairnesses of this system. We had one lawyer representing Mumia. Incredibly, a lawyer who had just gone into private practice. He had just opened up his office. When he was assigned this murder case, he had never tried a murder case, mm-hmm. despite what, you know, was alleged later, years later. He didn't even have file cabinets in his office. And the prosecution, on the other hand, had the whole DA's office, district attorney's detectives, and the police department building evidence against Mumia. So just on the surface, it wasn't fair in any sort of way. During the trial, the police and the prosecution withheld evidence. There was very crucial evidence that they did not make available to the defense. That's a violation of the law. Some information they only half gave them. And let me give you an example. Mumia was charged with killing a police officer. Mumia's defense was that, you know, I didn't do it. And the person who did do the shooting ran away. This was consistent with what a lot of eyewitnesses saw, including eyewitnesses who testified for the prosecution, but they eventually changed their stories. It didn't come out until 12 years later that the slain officer had in his shirt pocket a driver's license application for a man named Kenneth Freeman. Kenneth Freeman was a friend of Mumia's brother, and the 99% probability is that Kenneth Freeman was with Mumia's brother that night, and extraordinarily strong likelihood that Kenneth Freeman was the guy who ran away, that everybody saw. Now, this critical piece of evidence was extraordinarily important to that layer of proof that there was a third person, but the jury never heard that. And one of the things that the amnesty report said was that the jury never heard even half of the evidence that was available in the case. So if the jury didn't hear half of the evidence, how could the verdict that they reach be any way considered reliable?
Thank you. That's very helpful. Another caller? Yep.
Hey, hello.
Hello, listener, caller.
Hello, how are you doing?
Yes. What is your question?
I just want to say to all of you, please keep up the good fight. And, I mean, as Pan Africa pointed out, this case is just one of so many, you know, of people that are victims of prosecutorial misconduct. I mean, whether it's Jamil Al-Alameen, a.k.a. Rap Brown,
mm-hmm.
whether it's the young men who 20 years ago were railroaded for the rape of the Central Park jogger. You know, so many cases I can think of. And if Attorney General Eric Holder can personally apologize for the treatment of Ted Stevens, I don't understand how a rich and powerful white senator could be a civil rights victim, but nevertheless, if he could do that for him and apologize personally, then these other cases and others he should look at. That's all I need to say. And once again, keep up the good fight.
Thank you, and please join us on Saturday if you possibly can. I just want to add that the specific that they went ballistics about in relation to Stevens was the withholding of critical evidence from the defense. I want to repeat, because Lynn just explained how profound that withholding of evidence was in Mumia's case and how critical it was to the possibility of his being proved innocent. And yet that is the issue that they emphasized with respect to what the prosecutors did that was wrong in Stephen's case. So, Eric Holder, if you're listening, we're going to hold you accountable for being consistent in your judicial rulings. Next caller, please. Hello?
Yes, on the move, my sister.
On the move.
Yeah, move to Cuba where you're...
All right. A lot of us would love to move to Cuba. It's not that easy, and many of us are looking for financial support to enable that. Next caller, please. Hello?
Yeah. Okay, I've been following the case for years and years. You were basically speaking about due process, you know, as far as withholding evidence and the racial aspect, you know, the Batson ruling. But can I speak on the facts of the case for a second?
Sure.
You know, a book was...
Quickly, because we're running out of time.
All right, you know, a book was written showing that the five slugs recovered at the scene were 38 caliber, and they matched Mumia's legally registered gun, which he always carried with him. So how can you get beyond that? I know procedure's procedure, but the facts
okay.
say something else
okay.
about
well,
it, the weapon.
All right, we heard your question. Lynn, do you want to answer that, or Ori?
Yes,
go ahead.
If I could, but I'll defer to someone else, but I would really love to answer that question.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Lynn. You sound really ready to go.
The facts of the matter is that the ballistics did not match.
Exactly.
The bullets that were recovered, the police department's own ballistics experts said that the bullets were too degraded to match to any gun.
That was a bullet
so
in
they
his
said,
head.
Wait, caller, please let him finish.
They said that the bullets would be consistent with a bullet that was fired from a 38 caliber weapon. And they conceded that that consistency could match thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of weapons. So there was no direct match. It looked circumstantially very strong, but also of even more importance, the prosecution's contention is that Abu-Jamal shot the police officer. The police officer fell down. Abu-Jamal straddled the police officer, fired a number of times, until he hit him once between the eyes. Now, minutes ago, Suzanne made reference to the Polakoff photos. These were photos of a photojournalist who was at the scene of the crime minutes after it took place and minutes, almost half an hour before the police department's crime scene investigation got there. He took photographs of where the slain officer had fallen. And there are absolutely no divot marks, no holes, no bullet marks in the sidewalk that would be consistent with what the prosecution said, that Mumia fired down on the ground, missed the officer a few times before he hit him. Now, those photographs have been sent to a satellite deep space scientist at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory out west. His job is to enhance photos that are taken in deep space to see stars and stuff like that. He enhanced those photographs with all of his scientific equipment and could not find a single mark. So this notion that Abu-Jamal, one, shot at the police officer is refuted by hard evidence. And also this notion that the bullets came from his gun were refuted by the police department's own ballistics expert in their testimony. Now, the jury believed another thing. They ruled differently. But I'm just saying, if you read the cold transcript and what the guy said...
Are you telling me the police department got on the stand? And
we don't have time for further clarification of your question. I'm sorry, caller. We will probably open up the lines again next week. I'm going to be covering this show for the next 4 weeks. We were supposed to do a program tonight on parole, where Eddie Ellis and Larry White and Cindy Adesadiq was going to be joining us, but given the urgency on the Mumia situation and given what the ruling that just came down, we changed that order. So on the 30th of this month, that will be the topic. The next couple of weeks, we're going to be dealing with the book party on Mumia, with the great debate that's scheduled in Harlem on the death penalty in Mumia, and we ask everybody to tune in. Also, everybody to please show up for the meeting, the emergency meeting, this Saturday at 6 p.m. at the International Action Center or Solidarity Center, 55 West 17th Street. Thank you all, the guests in studio and outside. People really, I'm sure, are appreciating your contributions tremendously, and I very much appreciate you taking out the time to both be here and be on the phone. On a Move, everybody. See you next week, and listen to the words of this song by Abi Odun of The Last Poets.
Across the Atlantic Ocean to make slavery our devotion. Some of us had to cry. Some of us tried to fly. Because all of us knew we were sentenced to die. When they had us working like a mule, our blood, sweat, and tears became the fuel to make this American bitch rich. On black humanity, they pulled the switch. Our future, they would deny. They had sentenced us to die. When they took our names, gave us shame, took our drums and said we were dumb. When they called us nigger, then they pulled the trigger. When they gave us Jesus, it was poison, pudding, and pie. And making him white was just another damn lie. There was no question, they had sentenced us to die. Now don't you try to read or run away. Don't you be too smart and have something to say. You're a devoted slave, and that's who you be. You wouldn't know what to do if you was free. So just say your prayers and moan inside, 'cause every one of y'all was sentenced to die.